Well, in my first sermon here in February, I mentioned how these three consecutive psalms, Psalm 61, Psalm 62, and Psalm 63, were of great comfort to me during my recovery from burnout, during this time of breakdown. And in Psalm 61, which I preached on that day, you see the psalmist, it was our meditative scripture today, right? You see the psalmist desperately crying to God. In his extremity, he says, from the ends of the earth, with his fainting heart. And his prayer was to be led to what he called a rock that is higher than I. And this, we said, was just what God does for us in Jesus Christ. The eternal Son of God descends and he lifts us up on high. He makes us to dwell in his heavenly sanctuary forever, taking refuge under the shelter of his wings. Even now, by faith, our lives, right? The mystery of your life, your interior being, is hidden. It is safe. Your house may not be safe, right? Your physical life may not be safe, but you have died, and your life is hidden with Christ in God, safe with Christ in the heavenly places, who's a high tower against the enemy. And so today what I'd like to do is look at the opening words of the next psalm, the second of the three, Psalm 62. When I originally started this little project, I thought I'll preach one sermon on 61, one on 62, and one on 63. And I was working on this sermon on Psalm 62, and I got into it and I realized, okay, I've got too much material. I'm going to have to preach one sermon just on the first line. And then I kept working and I realized that's not going to work. I'm going to have to preach one sermon on the first three words of the first line. So this sermon is not ambitious in that regard. It is an attempt to unpack just a bit the first three words of Psalm 62. That's it. I'm just going to allude to the rest. So we'll make 2 points. 3 words, 2 points. God and alone. Right, first then, God. This is a majestic opening line. I have to admit, my heart has been captured by it over the past few months, right? The psalm opens like this: for God alone my soul waits in silence. Just absolutely beautiful. Hopefully next month, the next time we come back to the Psalms, because we've been trying to preach on a psalm once a month, we can look at what it means to wait on God in silence. But today we want to look at the first three words, for God alone. Now, notice this opening line, though. It's not a prayer per se, right? But it's a statement of fact. Like, it's a description of the current state of the psalmist's soul. This is what I am doing. Waiting in silence for God alone. Right? In a hectic, hyper-busy American culture, this is like an injection from another land, right? An intrusion, a very welcome and needed one. This is what I am doing. I am waiting in silence for God alone. And this line is repeated in verse 5, if you look down there. But there, he exhorts his soul. He speaks to himself and he says, for God alone, O my soul, wait in silence. So this is what he does, and this is what he tells himself to do. Right? This is what I am doing. This is what I speak to myself about doing. And notice, the psalmist does not do this in a state of detached mysticism. Right, some peaceful state of, you know, meditation. Although meditation of some sort is involved if one is going to do this. He says this in the middle of life. He has real enemies if you read the psalm. He faces real threats. These enemies are alluded to in verses 3 and 4 and verses 9 and 10, which we didn't read. Now, the exact character of the enemies and the nature of the opposition he faces, that's not of real concern for our purposes here today. But the fact that he is under stress, that he's under fire, Right? That we want to remember. And in that context, then, we get the utterance. For God alone, my soul waits in silence. First, to state the obvious, the one he is waiting for is God. To put this in fully Christian terms, he is waiting for the triune God. Now, I think what is required here, when we hear and when we speak the word God, is a kind of spiritual exercise to avoid our numbness to the term, right? Our casual familiarity with it, our overuse of it, which ends up being a kind of profaning of it, right? What is required in an ideal world is a kind of insertion. You hear the word God and you insert a summary, a reasonable summary, not an exhaustive summary, no one can do that, but some kind of robust summary of all the reflection of the whole Christian tradition on the majesty of just who it is we are speaking of when we say God. Without doing this, of course, our conception of God becomes, A, it becomes deistic, and B, it becomes thin, and C, it fades into the background. Now, we can't do that here, nor am I fit to do it. But we can try and scratch the surface just a little as a reminder to help us fill out a bit of the who we are speaking about. Because we're very fast to run past God to the thing that God has us doing. I'll come back to that. So, just for a couple minutes. Now, even apart from his works, even apart from all of his wondrous deeds, right, that is considered in his eternal, immutable, unchanging, absolute being, before creation, before the worlds came to be, the triune God is a vast, unmeasured, glorious mystery, thick with wonder, infinitely beautiful, and blessed, happy, full, lovely. Right, words fail us here. A communion of Father, Son, and Spirit in light and life and in light, in love. Three persons, one God. Lacking nothing, right? Depending on nothing, needing nothing, threatened by nothing. Hymned and adored without ceasing. In the heavenly Zion, by myriads of fiery angelic hosts, and later to be gazed upon in light and splendor by the departed saints, those called the spirits of the just made perfect. And this one, this radiant God, incomparable in himself, right? This is the God who asks, "To whom will you compare me?" Right, there's something fundamentally illegitimate about even comparing this God to other gods because he's not a member of any class of beings. As the history of the church has put it, mostly in the Middle Ages, God is not in any genus. There's not a genus or a category called gods of which the Christian God is the greatest. The Christian God is not even in the category of being because he's the ground of being. He's the great I am. He just is. He's not a member of any class. He's singular and distinct. For this one, the psalmist waits. He waits. And this one, out of the overflow of his love, not out of any need, right? Apart from any need, he freely creates the world. The Father, the God who always was Father, becomes Creator. And having created the world, this God sustains it and he guides it. And he guides it in the teeth of our rebellion, our sin, our misery, our wretchedness, and our ruin. He says no to our no. Right? He reconciles the world. He redeems the world. He perfects the world. He summons the world and us and the whole created order back into holy fellowship with himself, who is the thrice holy one. That's what he's doing. And he shall perfect and he shall consummate the created order, bringing us and it to a glory that far surpasses the glory Adam enjoyed in paradise. For this one, the psalmist waits. And the consummation of the works of this God are what the Christian tradition calls the beatific vision, the happy vision, the blessed vision, the beatific vision. That is, namely, that at the end of our pilgrimage, its goal is gazing upon and adoring the beauty of the triune majesty in everlasting glory, seeing the face of God. Of doing by sight what we now do by faith. Right? When we were converted, Paul says in 2 Corinthians 4 that the God who said, "Let light shine out of darkness," there's the first creation, Genesis 1, has shown in our hearts, there's the second creation, to give the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ. Right? The light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ, that is the beatific vision. That is the end toward which all God's activity with us is pointed. Right? And as an echo or a counterpart to that, that is to be the end to which all Christian activity is pointed. We behold Christ's face by faith now. But the book of Revelation tells us in chapter 22 that we shall behold it in the new creation with resurrected bodies, with our physical eyes. Faith shall become sight. His servants shall see his face. Right, so to simplify this then, being a Christian is about God. Strange thing to have to say, but you have to say it sometimes. It is about this God. It's not about monotheism or believing in a God. But this one God, this luminous mystery of Father, Son, and Spirit. This God who creates and redeems for this end. To see him face to face with the whole triumphant host on high. And to engage in unceasing, endless worship. Right? For this God, the psalmist waits. Because he will save the psalmist in the midst of his current suffering. And he will bring him at last with us to salvation's goal, to its fullness in the beatific vision. So, this God then, once we start to grasp the outline, the edges, right? This God can never become a means to an end. As Romans 11 puts it this way, from him and through him and to him are all things. Right? God is the source, God is the agent, and God is the goal of all things. And thus to glorify this God and to enjoy this God, right? This is our chief end, right? Westminster Shorter Catechism. For this one, the psalmist waits. So that is, in barest outline, God. The second point is alone. This psalm, the 19th century English preacher, C.H. Spurgeon, I'm sure many of you know who he is. Spurgeon said this was the only or of the alone psalm, because the word for only or alone is used 6 times in the psalm. Only, alone, only, alone. God only, God alone. Now, a few years back, I did a series. It's the first time I've ever done this in ministry, just on God. And I had an older man write me an email saying, "I've waited 50 plus years for this series because I've never heard any preacher preach on God." Now, I'm sure there are plenty out there who have, at least if you consider maybe a series on God's attributes. But I preached on God. I finally decided, yeah, this was a great need of my congregation. Just God. Who is God? His attributes. I had a sermon on God's infinity, a sermon on God's eternity, a sermon on God's holiness, his goodness, his love, his unchangeableness, all throughout. And I started that series with this provocative proposition. Here it is. Christians are not much interested in God. Christians are not much interested in God. I mean, in a tangential way, they are. You know, if he bears down upon their situation, it seems preposterous, maybe even offensive to say that. I understand. What am I even talking about? So one way to get at this is what I've called the God and X problem, where X is something good, even noble, even Christian, some noble Christian thing. And all Christians have their X because we all have vocations, right? We all have gifts and we all have callings. There's nothing wrong with X. X might be prayer. X might be ministry. It might be preaching. It might be teaching. It might be ministering to the poor. It might be, who knows, any number of wholesome things. It might be engaging American culture. It might be Christianity and the arts. Whatever it is, it could be anything. But what happens is, over time, X becomes big, like enormous, and God himself becomes small. He fades into the background. You realize over time, he's just there to underwrite X. Like, we need his power, and we need his help, and we need his prestige, and we need his name, but X is the thing. He's not the thing. X is the end, and God has slid into this position where he becomes a means to an end, and that's nothing but idolatry. So, in fact, at some point, if God had seven persons in his being instead of three, X would look pretty much the same. Nothing would change on the ground. Right? If God announced from heaven tonight, I have four persons in my being, not three, everybody would say, well, my ministry is pretty much intact. Because we just need you as a means to the end. All order and proportion has been slowly lost. Order and proportion are two of my favorite words. I say them a lot. Let me just stop for a second and tell you how important they are. Order means, order is, you know, one, two, three. Order means get things in their right order of proportion. And the first thing is the majesty and the being of the triune God, right? And the 798th thing is probably the things that people are passionate about. But get the order of stuff right. Christians don't do this. And then get the proportion right. The big things are big. The medium things are medium. The little things are little, right? So order and proportion gets lost. And this is because serving and knowing God becomes collapsed into, it becomes identified with being busy with X. Right? Of course, Lord, I can't sit and wait on you in silence. I'm busy feeding the poor or doing my Christian Bible studies all the time or whatever the Christian activity is. So God becomes a means to accomplish X. God in himself, this is the point, God in himself, apart from and above all activity, all created things, holds little to no interest. Right? To the extent that God's going to help our church or help our family or help our culture, God's very important. But in and of himself, apart from all created things, he holds little interest. God is, in the words of one theologian, weightless for the American church. He's weightless. Imagine if you were to set the ground rules for one cup of coffee, like one conversation. The ground rules are, in this conversation, we can't speak of anything but God. Nothing in the created order. You can't talk about yourself. You can't talk about your wife. You can't talk about your kids. You can't talk about your work. You can't talk about your ministry. You and I are just going to have coffee, and we're going to talk about the being of God. Well, that's like, I think we can get like 11 seconds out of that, maybe. It's impossible to do it. No one's interested in it. Try it. People think you're a self-righteous twit if you try it. Trust me. Right? So, That, I think, exposes the issue, though. Could we have a sustained conversation just about God? Because that's all we're going to do for eternity. So, you know, this could sound like, well, theologians like to do that. You can't expect average, normal, busy people to be talking about the Trinity or the issues of Christology and all of that. That's just a preposterous kind of a hyper-intellectual approach to things or something like that. To that, I want to quote from Gregory of Nyssa. Gregory of Nyssa was a 4th century church father, a famous one. He's from Turkey. He's one of what are called the Cappadocians, from Cappadocia in Turkey. There was two others, and he's the third one. And they helped preserve the Christian church and its teaching about the Trinity. And so this is the 4th century, and Nyssa's complaining that the common people are always talking about this, and he can't get them to talk about anything else. Here's Nyssa's quote. He says, "If you ask someone to give you change, he philosophizes about the begotten and the unbegotten." By the way, that's never happened to me at Kroger. But apparently in the 4th century, if you ask somebody to give you change, you could get a discourse on the begotten and the unbegotten. This is like some fantastic fantasy world that I'd like to live in, right? Like just go back to the 4th. Can I just go back to the 4th century for 1 week? Right? So this is the quote. "If you ask someone to give you change, he philosophizes about the begotten and the unbegotten. If you inquire about the price of a loaf, you are told by way of reply that the Father is greater and the Son is inferior. If you ask, 'Is my bath ready?' the attendant answers that the Son was made out of nothing." Like, that's all people wanted to talk about was Christology and Trinitarian theology. Now, maybe he's exaggerating, right? But, you know, it'd be nice to have a little more of that. Anyway, I want to draw this point out a little bit more from our first lesson from Isaiah 40. So, you know, if you have a Bible, you should turn to Isaiah 40 and start at verse 12, because I want to point a few things out that help us, you know, this order and proportion question, they help get it right, I think. The passage, right, from Isaiah 40 speaks of the radical and infinite difference between God, who is unmeasured, and the whole scope of human existence. So Isaiah 40 verse 13 asks, "Who has measured the Spirit of the Lord, or what man shows him his counsel?" The point is that God's unaided by his creation, right? You know, there is a sense, this is an aside, but you do not add any glory to God by glorifying him, right? You guys know that, right? You can't make God any more majestic, any more happy, any more full, any more glorious than he is. The existence of a billion worlds of completely spotless, perfectly obedient Christians would not make God any more full or any more happy. He stands in no need. When we glorify God, all we are doing is ascribing the glory that is already his. So it's very important to see that God has no needs. And in a certain sense, you can't even worship God properly until you come to see he has no need for your worship. None whatsoever. It does nothing to him as far as affecting his glory. So he's unaided by his creation. His counsel, his justice, his understanding are his own. And the following verses draw out the implications of the immensity, the self-sufficient wisdom of God, the transcendent one, the uncreated creator. Look at verse 15. "Behold, the nations are like a drop from a bucket and are accounted as dust on the scales. Behold, he takes up the coastlands like fine dust." In verse 12, we're told that the waters of the whole creation can be measured in the hollow of his hand. The idea is this, right? God can have all the water in the world right here. You know, if you had to use some sort of scale, it'd be, you know, that's the best you can do as a creational analogy. He can measure all the waters of the world in the palm or the hollow of his hand. And the nations then are just a drop from that little bucket. Like, if the mountains and the hills can be weighed on a standard everyday scale, verse 12, then the nations, he says, are like dust on the scale, which has no weight at all. And the coastlands, he says in the text, have even finer, they're finer, less significant dust. Now think about this perspective, because Isaiah has this vision of the transcendent God. There are, I looked it up, there's 195 nations in the world right now. But over the course of human history, there have been thousands, perhaps tens of thousands of nations and empires, right? And every one of them has a complex history. Every one of them is full of policy decisions and politics and all the roiling stuff of life, right? America's just one. So think of American culture and all the American, you know, political stuff that gets us riled up, and then multiply that by thousands and thousands and thousands of nations and thousands of policies and thousands of decisions across thousands of years. All the nations. And you know what Isaiah says when he sees the majesty of God and he thinks of that? He says they are like the dust that's left when you weigh something on a scale. It's finer than that. He says it's like, that's it. That's all the nations. How does someone get this vision? Well, they first see God, like Isaiah saw in chapter 6, and they see him in 40. And when you see him, every single created thing compiled together looks like nothing. Looks lighter than the dust. This is what I mean by order and proportion. For Isaiah, God is weighty and all the nations. Again, not just America, not just this particular problem in America. All the nations are weightless. He has no God and X problem. And the nations, they come back into view in verse 17. Look at this. All the nations, the whole sum of them, are as nothing before him. They are accounted by him as less than nothing and emptiness. The word for nothing here, which Isaiah uses twice, actually means non-existence. The vision of God, the Creator, is so weighty, so palpably real, so full of glory, it's as if the nations didn't exist. Think about that. Right? Think about that for the American church. That will tell you that Christians are not much interested in God, that they have the whole picture out of distortion and size and order. Right? In the second half of verse 17, it says that the nations are, if possible, less than non-existent. Well, it's as if Isaiah cannot get enough contempt to pour on the nations. They're like dust. They're like non-existent. They're less than non-existent. And he uses the word empty at the end of verse 17, which literally means void. It's the same word used in Genesis 1 of the original unformed creation. The earth was formless and void. The nations then, all of the nations, are a contentless abyss of nothingness. Which I've always thought should be chiseled on the UN building in New York City. What is missing in our endless chattering about American culture is the transcendent perspective of this text. I told a person recently, I said, I will talk to you about this particular policy in American politics when you convince me that it's less than nothing in light of the transcendent vision of the triune God. When you have come to see it as nothing, as contentless, then we can talk about it. Because the point in the text of Isaiah is not that God despises the nations. He will, in fact, redeem the nations, of course. They will, Isaiah tells us, stream into Zion. The point, though, is that in comparison to his being, they are lighter than the finest dust. In and of themselves, they are virtually nothing. Right? The vision of the incomparable God must do this work for our theology of the nations, for our politics. I don't know what's on the other side of this work for an American Christian political. I don't know. You know why? Because I haven't done this work. We have to do this work. Right? God, really, really, really big. America, really, really, really small. There it is for the children. That's the whole sermon for children. You know, I was struck by this week. Because when you think of, when God becomes big like this, right? The heavenly reality of God, right? You've died, your life is hidden, right? You want to see God, so heaven and the age to come into clearer focus, right? You can't have, I was just reading D.A. Carson on this, he says, you cannot have biblical spirituality where you do not have a focus, a centeredness on the age to come. The age to come cannot merely be a footnote, but it has to be a palpable reality. The three things go together, God, heaven, and the age to come. But one of the things that has struck me, and it struck me the last time we were here too, a decade or so ago, is that in a region like this, where you might have, I don't know, 20 tornado warnings a year, and I don't know how many, whatever the rest are called, watches, and is you have an opportunity to reflect on some things, but often you end up getting something that's very thin out of it. Namely, thank God he protected us. Apparently he protects people until he doesn't protect them. Right? Keith has a very good friend who died. You have to deal with that. Well, then you pray for that family. Right, so you get a lot of that. We'll pray for the families. And there's a lot of Southern stoicism, which is we'll rebuild. Like you live in Oklahoma, you live in Arkansas, it's like, well, the tornadoes knocked our towns down, we're going to rebuild. All that's fine. There's nothing wrong with it. But it's woefully incomplete. Because this is like a vivid reminder to us every day that the whole creation is groaning and yearning and travail to be liberated. That's what a tornado should teach. It should teach that the whole created order has a curse on it, and that the only thing that can fix this is the appearance of Jesus, the redemption of our bodies, and the reordering of all the disordered powers that are in creation, right? The resurrection of the dead, and the reestablishing of the creation under the dominion of man without any of these disorders. Right? It won't do to say, well, thank God we were safe. Of course, sure, thank God we were safe, but we might not be safe. What Paul would say is, when you see a tornado, what you should see is the creation is groaning. And what's the creation groaning for? The glory of the sons of God to be revealed when Christ appears again in glory. The whole place is a laboratory for orienting people toward heaven and toward the age to come. But instead, it's all thinned down. Right? And it's rarely, again, this is an example of how we are just simply not theocentric in what we think. Right? You spent all this work, like we've been working on our house, most of you have been working on our house for weeks and months, right? And you're reminded, like here every week, the whole thing could just blow away in an instant. So what's the point? Well, the point is check your house insurance. But no, the point is, you have a house made without hands, eternal in the heavens. That should be the point. Because eventually you're leaving this house anyway. Right? What we want is no tornadoes. Right? No funerals. No dead children. Zero. Because we want to see God face to face in glory. We want the whole creation subdued to his majesty. Here's the words of Spurgeon. I mentioned Spurgeon before, but I'm going to cite him again. Now, this is a long quote, so hang in there, please, because it's hard to improve on this. Here's what he says. It has been said by someone that the proper study of mankind is man. I will not oppose the idea. But is equally true that the proper study of God's elect is God. The proper study of the Christian is the Godhead. The highest science, the loftiest speculation, the mightiest philosophy which can ever engage the attention of a child of God is the name, the nature, the person, the work, the doings, and the existence of the great God whom he calls his Father. There is something exceedingly improving to the mind in a contemplation of the divinity. It is a subject so vast that all our thoughts are lost in its immensity, so deep that our pride is drowned in its infinity. When we come to this master science, we find that our plumb line cannot sound its depth, and that our eagle eye cannot see its height. No subject of contemplation will tend more to humble the mind than thoughts of God. But while this subject humbles the mind, it also expands it. He who often thinks of God will have a larger mind than the man who simply plods around this narrow globe. The most excellent study for expanding the soul is the science of Christ and him crucified and the knowledge of the Godhead in the glorious Trinity. He continues, nothing will so enlarge the intellect, nothing so magnifies the whole soul of man as a devout, earnest, continued investigation into the great subject of the deity. And while humbling and expanding, the subject is eminently consoling. So here he says, this is a place of consolation. He says, oh, there is in contemplating Christ a balm for every wound. In musing on the Father, there is a calming for every grief. Right? The psalmist, when he says, in silence, my soul waits for God alone, God is comforting him in the midst of life. There's consolation there. And that's what Spurgeon is saying, would you lose your sorrows, he says? Would you drown your cares? Then go plunge yourself in the Godhead's deepest sea and be lost in his immensity. And you shall come forth as from a couch of rest, refreshed and invigorated. I know nothing which can so comfort the soul as a devout musing upon the subject of the Godhead. Right, that's the end of the quote. Now, listen. He was 20 years old when he wrote that. 20. You know what that means? He didn't have a God and X problem. He didn't have it. The psalmist is waiting for God alone. Both words are super critical. He's not waiting for God in the next election. He's waiting for God alone. And the reason for this, the second half of verse 1 says, is that from God comes his salvation. Present and future, salvation comes from God alone. Of course, our Lord uses means, but the outcome is always in his hands. God is the source and the fount of our salvation, and thus we wait for him alone. You'll notice this as you go through the Psalms. I know when I went through my dark period, Psalm 25, for example, sticks out. There the psalmist says things like, my soul waits for God all the day long. All day long I wait for you. This posture of waiting is not like for special times of quiet times. It is the posture of Christian souls. We are always waiting for God, right? 1 Thessalonians 1, you turned from your idols to serve the living and true God and to wait. That's what converts do, to wait for his son from heaven who will deliver us from the wrath which is to come. We're always, always waiting for him and him alone. Look at verse 7. He says, his salvation and his glory rest on God. Everything comes from God. Everything rests on God. The God who is his rock and his salvation. So notice this, then. It's not just that our salvation is from God, or that our salvation rests on God alone. Right? Verse 6 tells us that God alone is our salvation. Right, this changes the game, right? The triune God of glory, Father, Son, and Spirit, is the content of your salvation. That's the prize you get at the end, right? God is our salvation. The God who is incomparable and thus alone, who is the only God, he alone, he only is our salvation. And on him and on that salvation we rest, secure. So to conclude, having God alone is to have everything. Dividing our affections between God and other things, including good things, is to possess nothing aright. It's to possess nothing aright, and it's to risk losing everything. Gerhardus Voss, I don't have the quote in front of me, but he speaks of this 100 years ago, Dutch Reformed theologian, about how easily God is made a means to an end by religious people. Right, he said, you can even worship your own religion. Right, you ever meet a person and you think this person is more passionate about Christianity than they are about God? Right, you can find that. That's out there, right? Because you know, it's like what America needs is Christianity. Right, we need some more Christianity in the schools. It's like, okay, I know what you mean, but it's possible, Voss says, to worship your own religion, to realize that God himself has just become a thing. That is now a means to an end, right? To possess God with other things is to risk losing God and the other things. Thus, we are called here to wait and to seek God, to seek that God alone would be enthroned and would reign unrivaled. We're all pilgrims here. Nobody has this wired, least of all me. But the psalm calls us to seek that God alone would be enthroned and would reign without rivals over the whole of our inner being, our will, and the worship of our souls, even as he reigns over all of creation. As the Reformation slogan, Sola Deo Gloria, would have it, to God alone, that's the sola, to God alone be the glory. Amen.